You mean how I became
Perhaps
an accompanist?
Perhaps how you became an accompanist from this, we will.
That was an unusual combination of very favorable circumstances. I was born as the son of two singers, and so got my training as soon as I could distinguish the black from the white keys practically at home. When I had to play for my parents, my father was a voice teacher, so I started very early playing for his pupils. And from there on, it was an easy way, down or up, as you wanted to put it, into the job and the profession of an accompanist, which I enjoyed then and still enjoy.
So it was accompanying your father first then?
That's right.
Where was this, Mr. Ulanovsky?
It was in Vienna, where I was born, raised, got all my musical education. It also might be of interest that when Mr. Hefliger mentioned that this Song of the Earth, in which he performed the tenor part, was Bruno Walter's last recording of this work, I, in a more modest capacity, was active in the first recording that Bruno Walter made of the work, because a very early recording was made during a concert of the Philharmonic Orchestra in Vienna, where Walter performed Mahler, as he so often did, and where I played the celesta part. For many years I had been an incidental piano and celesta and harpsichord, even piano player in the orchestra. It was my privilege to play under all the big conductors. And when Mr. Hefliger sang the tenor part, I was reminded of these many years ago when I played in the same work.
In a way, the completion of a cycle.
Exactly.
A Walter cycle.
That was my reaction, a very personal one, I admit.
It seems, again, you use the word a personal reaction. The person and the artist on the stage cannot be separated. They're parts of the same being.
I think so. Of course, there are certain aspects of the person that come more into the spotlight on the stage, but I don't think you can easily separate the two.
Were there, in your Viennese boyhood, were there major influences among piano players in your memory?
I must admit that this is so long ago that I can only remember very few and rather disconnected facts about it. Of course, everybody who played any instrument or who sang came to Vienna just as they come to New York or Chicago to perform. And as a student, I listened to as many concerts as I could get in to hear. But I could not say that any particular man exerted that much influence, because I was interested in too many different aspects. I was playing piano, I also studied the violin and viola, and I took theory lessons and played chamber music, so that practically anything in the whole realm of music was of vital interest to me.
All interested you. But it was the piano primarily. You said you studied the viola, the violin, chamber music.
Was that was for the fun of it, in order to get a better aspect, more rounded idea of what music was, even for the performer. But piano naturally was my main instrument and eventually my bread and butter.
Well, the phrase to describe you, accompanist, the master accompanist, as distinguished, say, from a solo pianist.
Well, these are two completely different things, and they are distinguished not only by the fact that there's entirely different literature. In comparison, I should say that the accompanist has so much less to worry about. There are so many fewer notes to practice, and that was one of the great attractions to me in the profession of an accompanist, because it left the 8 or 10 hours that the solo pianist has to practice every day for other purposes, which I valued very much. Then, of course, it's a matter of temperament, because if there is something in your personal build-up that cries out for asserting yourself and having no other gods beside you, then, of course, you are the born soloist. But in the other case, if you enjoy working together in a team, ensemble of 2 or 4 or more people, then, of course, the possibility of doing accompanying or chamber music work is a much closer one.
And isn't there a, thinking about you, Mr. Ulanowski, isn't there the added challenge to an accompanist, though he may play less than a soloist, the challenge of that other being that, not, I don't want to use the word adjustment, because adjustment isn't right either, the sensing of the nuances and all. You have accompanied so many of our finest vocalists. This challenge of...
Oh, yes, always to expect the unexpected, no matter how well rehearsed something may be. Also, the challenge of performing one and the same piece with different artists from completely different angles, and in a greater majority of cases, even in a completely new way with the same artist on different occasions. So that there is actually no repetition, even in as limited a repertory as the vocal literature may be in comparison with the vast solo repertory.
The different experience in accompanying the same artist in the same number. For example, let us assume Lotta Lehmann. Again, if we may come back to Madame Lehmann. You've accompanied her some 50 times in New York
alone, yes.
And let us say Andy Musik, for example, any number of times. Yeah. Yes. And yet each time... There was another nuance. It was never quite the same, was it?
It could never be quite the same. You have to realize that, of course, as you repeat the performance of one and the same thing, the large outlines will be the same. They will fall into a predictable pattern. It is the very small details, the taking of a breath, the taking of a bigger breath here, the accentuation of this part of the sentence rather than the next, heightening of the inflection in another. These assume a major importance because they are the distinguishing marks between the last week's performance or last year's performance. It is not that they are intrinsically of great value. They only serve to illustrate to yourself that there is no dead, no empty repetition of anything if somebody goes at it with the freshness and the spontaneity of a new experience.
So no matter how planned a recital might be, the element, there is always that element of some improvisation.
Oh, there should be, definitely. Yes. The ideal is that you prepare something extremely well, carefully, sometimes over weeks or months, and then in a moment of performance, after they have sort of settled in a groove, you make yourself forget those and create, as it were, completely from scratch. You don't do it, fortunately, because all these things that you have elaborated in the rehearsals of weeks and months before have become routine, in the better sense of the word.
Isn't this a marvelous paradox? The more you prepare, the more seriously two artists, the singer and the accompanist, prepare, the better chance there is for freshness, in a true sense.
Yes,
That's
right. If the preparation is always a creative one, if it is not just repetition for repetition's sake, then I would say that this holds true.
Mr. Ulanowski, I'm not asking for anecdotes because it's really minor, but you have accompanied so many different artists, I imagine so many different temperaments too.
Oh, yes.
And yet you find... Each time your approach as an accompanist is—it's new. You start fresh, as though you start fresh again.
For me, it is easier in a way because I react to whatever I find the emotional or intellectual atmosphere to be set by the singer. After all, he has the much more difficult job to perform, and it is only right that I sort of find the same level of approach, emotional, intellectual, stylistic, aesthetic, and what have you. And once this is established, we can discuss possible changes where it might be of value. But for a lot of obvious reasons, it is easier for me to adapt myself and the way I play the accompaniments to the requirements of the singer's preference than the other way around. Although in the last analysis, when people get together for a longer period of work, it always develops into a system of give and take, of exchange of information, of comparing notes, that finally there doesn't seem to be any coercion. That only happens when there are extraordinary circumstances influencing the performance, or when a singer feels that he is not in complete control of all his ordinary vocal gifts, and that a certain extra care is required of the accompanist to be on the alert and do things a little differently from the accepted way. In that case, I might tell you a story.
Please do. I was hoping you would.
Which, however, concerns people that are long dead. The famous Polish pianist Ignaz Friedman, in his early days, was traveling as an accompanist to a singer, a tenor, who was well past his prime. And toward the end of the tour, it happened one night when the tenor was even more tired than usual, that in the middle of an aria, he dropped about 1.5 or 2 tones in the middle of a phrase. Without dropping more than a beat, Friedman transposed into the new key, and at the end of the concert, the singer was overjoyed at having such a fine and alert accompanist, and presented Friedman with an extra florin, which at that time was a fortune for young Friedman. I'd like to say that Friedman told this story on himself, that for the end of that tour, he always managed to start the one or the other piece of the program in a key which he knew would prove too high for the tenor, so that during that course, the tenor would have to drop, Friedman would drop with him, and cash the extra florin at the end
of
the
concert.
Picked
up a lot of florins that
way.
Yes. It's a marvelous technique.
Yeah. So there are, let us say, unusual experiences as well as sources of income for the accompanist.
There is something else inherent in the story, though the story doesn't deal with the element of accident, of happy accident. Sometimes something can be accidental, and yet the accompanist or the vocalist can use that accident, make it become an asset.
Oh, yes. That, of course, depends entirely on the sang-froid, on the stage presence of the performer. These things do happen. Fortunately, they do, because they enrich the life of both performer and the audience. And as long as the performer knows how to make the accident rather a funny experience than a disaster, everybody gains by that. I remember once there was a long, beautiful program presented in Town Hall by the distinguished mezzo-soprano Martha Lipton. It was a very long program because she was intent on showing any number of facets of her art. And despite that fact, there were still people, lots of people left, who wanted encores. There was one encore and another encore. And then we came out when they still were clapping for the third encore, and people were sort of sitting down, the doors were being closed. It was quiet, and I raised my hands to play the introduction when from the back of the hall, a child's voice piped out very clearly, "Aren't we going home yet?" That was the wonderful thing to happen at the end of the concert. The house broke down. It took a long time before that last encore, which was fortunately a short and happy one, could be performed, and then that was over.
Martha Lipton, in a way, then welcomed this.
Oh, yes. Yes. I don't think that she had engaged a child to come in.
But a private clank.
Yes.
Anti-clank.
Yeah.
there's a point that Madame Lehman raised during one of her interviews here in Chicago on this station when she was teaching at Northwestern. And I'd like your opinion of this, Mr. Wilanowski. You've accompanied so many of the excellent singers. She was decrying the speed, the rush with which so many singers are brought to the fore these days. She spoke of more intense training. As a result, the singer grows more naturally. Do you feel this so today?
I'm aware of that, and I also am aware of the fact that the singers and the students cannot be blamed for an economic system that has exerted its force and its influence on the music life, just as it has done in any other direction. We live in an accelerated speed of experience everywhere, and it is very regrettable that in the field of art, where a slower development should be maintained, this cannot be done, at least not as much as it used to be done when I was a student. These are things that are very difficult to assess. Somebody with a very fast capacity for absorption, assimilation, and reflection will suffer less from that, but other people whose way of developing is slow will be very much at the mercy of good luck and connections before they find their own fulfillment, or rather come sufficiently close to the fulfillment of their potential.
And yet the person with the facility who, let us say, is able to span this obstacle, overcome this obstacle, isn't that a sad thing too? Perhaps too much facility and not enough of the time to call upon his innermost resources? You know, there's the great facility, and yet you feel there's more there perhaps if we're slower.
Certainly there would be, but then there is always the possibility, and let us say the hope, that these things will catch up with the performer, even though he may not have been able to assemble all these paraphernalia during his course of study. They will creep into his performance as he matures as a person. And I don't think that, it sounds a little corny, that anybody who is or wants to be a real artist ever stops learning. I find myself reviewing the same score that I have looked at 30 and 35 years ago, and I find new or different things in it. It is not because necessarily I have neglected to study this, but when you grow older, you look at things in a different way, so that you keep learning and adding new experiences, even if infinitesimal ones, to the store of what you know about any one piece.
You then do go back, you reread, you look over, relook.
Well, that is the singers that make me do that, because they always like to go back to the masterpieces of the 19th century. That is the great treasure chest of vocal literature. There's naturally music from before and after, but the vast bulk of the vocal literature in which I'm involved stems from the 19th century. There is no end of going back to that.
And in that going back, as you say, you are different now than you were some 20 years ago. You're a different man. And yes. So you look at that very same work, but there's a different pair of eyes involved now.
Yes, the only thing is I don't know it. I only assume it.
You assume it.
Yes.
Yet. Perhaps one last question, Mr. Well, there are many questions I'd like to ask you, Mr. Wilanowski. You're very gracious. An assessment on your part of concertgoers today. We speak of the speed which we live in today, technological advances, the rush. Is there a difference? Do they listen more or less? Do you sense this on the stage than, say, 20 years? This is a tough question. I know your own assessment of audiences today, say, contrasted with 20
that
years.
Is very hard for me
yes.
to say, because I could not really judge from their reaction how they listen. Because when they applaud, they may applaud a variety of things, some of which may not even have to do with their listening at all. The difference between, let us say, American and European audiences to me is something that, to my mind, has nothing to do with music at all. In Europe, by and large, the concerts start at 7 or 7:30. People go there having had a little snack, and they have supper afterwards. And I feel that listening to music or partaking in any artistic experience, even as a on the receiving end, is quite different when your stomach isn't full with a large dinner. And there, I believe, American audiences are at a disadvantage.
You feel then listening on an empty stomach or a light snack might be make them more conducive to another kind of food.
Yes, you are more alert, and there's no doubt about it that your reactions, both the active and the negative, are much faster, and you are more in tune with what comes from the stage than when you are busy watching your own digestion, so to speak.
Mr. Wolanowski, these comments you're making are very, well, I don't want to use the word profound, but they're very, very perceptive comments, certainly. They're both, they have very perceptive comments. I know there are many questions I'd like to ask you. I'm also thinking of your rest for the various concerts you have to perform. Anything you would care to say that you haven't said thus far? It could be anything in nature, your own feelings about music today, the art of the accompanist, or taste generally in reference to music today. Comments that you haven't said thus far that you feel like saying.
I think I'd like to come back to something that we discussed at the very beginning. The field of music is so diversified today, so much more than it was 100 or 200 years ago. There are so many more styles to be taken into account, so many more different ways to present music. We have the radio, the television, and so on. So that whatever I could say would have to be hedged in by considerations. This applies to this, but not to that, etc. I think the most important thing is the honesty with which you try to identify yourself with the composer, or when it comes to vocal literature, with composer and poet. To go back to what they wanted to put down in their combined work of sound and word, to go to the ends of your imagination in recreating the atmosphere out of which they have written this particular song, and then transmit it in terms of your own perception as well as in terms of your own artistry and vocal or instrumental gifts. Still, however, trying to be their spokesman rather than consider whatever you do as a playground for your particular personal endowment. If you do that, and if you keep that foremost in your work, I think the rest will take care of itself. It's just a matter of schooling and application.
We come back to the core of the apple, then. The artist, his honesty and his respect for the work that he is performing, no matter what the age in which he lives.
Yes, and I think that eventually will always tell.
Perhaps the best way to end this, to me, a very delightful and pleasurable conversation, Mr. Wolanowski, is in hearing the voice of Lotta Lehmann once again, the last song she sang during her farewell concert, An die Musik, which I imagine is almost the trademark.
Well, that is. That's the credo of every artist, certainly of every musician.
The joy that is in music, the love for music, and its
the credo and the thanksgiving.
The thanksgiving. Thank you very much, Paul Wolanowski.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Mr. Tackle.
I try to sing Andy Musik.